On October 3, 1980, a bomb was detonated outside a synagogue on Köpernick Street in Paris. 3 decades later, French investigators finally identified a suspect in the case. A Lebanese-Canadian sociology professor living a quiet life on the outskirts of Ottawa, Canada. Is Hassan Diab guilty?
Can you introduce yourself?
Or is he a scapegoat?
Hassan Diab.
From Canada Land, this is The Köpernick Affair. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
In the Northern Hemisphere, it has been frigid, but in South Sudan, a heat wave will keep kids out of school for weeks.
It is very difficult to be a child and to be going to school at this time of the year.
I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Today, how children cope with soaring temperatures in South Sudan. Also, 3 years into the war in Ukraine, another Russian drone attack.
Even though Ukrainians are resilient and they're standing united, they're also tired.
And comedians punching up in Venezuela.
When you make someone laugh, you open the heart. That's why dictators, they don't like comedians because they have more power than them.
Plus, we're hungry for eggs in the U.S. Why your next dozen may come from Turkey.
That's all ahead today on The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thank you for joining us this Monday. Leaders from around the world joined Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky in Ukraine today. It was a show of solidarity 3 years after Russia's full-scale invasion plunged the country into war. The U.S. was notably absent.
Alliances have been shifting since President Trump initiated talks with Russia's Vladimir Putin about ending the war without bringing Ukraine or Europe to the table. Today, after a weekend during which Russia targeted Ukraine with the biggest drone attack since the start of the war, Zelensky called on its longtime ally not to turn its back on Ukraine.
It's so important that American support, American assistance remains.
We start today's show with Volodymyr Soloviov, a journalist in Kyiv, who described that massive drone attack over the weekend from a Ukrainian point of view.
Ukrainians have been experiencing overnight drone and missile attacks for 3 years now. Over the past 2 weeks here in Kyiv, the drones were flying almost every night. Yes, that drone attack that you're referring to was excessive. It was pretty long. The air raids went off multiple times throughout the night. But, you know, for most of the Ukrainians, this was just another night in their three-year daily routine, if you will. And it was only until the next morning when the Air Force has announced that this has been the largest drone attack, the Ukrainians learned that it was the largest drone attack.
Another headline from this weekend, at his year-end press conference, President Volodymyr Zelensky said that he would be willing to step down if it meant peace and NATO membership for Ukraine. Volodymyr, I know you were covering that press conference. How are Ukrainians reacting to that statement?
Yes, Carolyn, I went to that press conference, and to put a little bit of the context, there was a question from one of the correspondents about what President Zelensky is willing to do to achieve the peace for Ukraine. And the question was, if it meant for President Zelensky to resign, would he resign in exchange for peace? And without hesitation, Volodymyr Zelensky said, yes, I would resign. And then almost half jokingly said, I can also exchange my resignation for NATO membership. Of course, the media picked it up immediately. It was reported by both Ukrainian and foreign media. And to be honest, Ukrainians have a very high confidence in President Zelensky. Most of Ukrainians at least see him as a very efficient leader in this time of crisis and in this time of war. So I think that most of the Ukrainians obviously welcomed this remark, and they still have confidence in the president.
There's a lot of tension right now between President Zelensky and Trump, to put it mildly. Trump has called Zelensky a dictator for not holding elections while Ukraine remains at war. I gather from what you just said that Ukrainians do not see it that way, that he's a dictator?
First of all, it is clearly stated in Ukrainian constitution that you cannot have elections during the times of war. And even realistically, it wouldn't be possible to have the elections where almost 25% of the country is occupied or is under heavy fighting or Russian bombardment. And if talking, you know, in general, broader terms about Zelensky's support, he still enjoys quite a large support among Ukrainian population. Just moments or hours after the news of President Trump's statement came to life, one of the polling companies released the results of their polling that they made earlier in February, which showed that President Zelensky has almost 57% of support across the entire country.
So today, on the third anniversary of the invasion of Ukraine, Zelensky is hosting European leaders. The U.S. is not represented at that meeting. What message does this gathering send?
Carolyn, absolutely. But it's not only the European leaders. The Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau is also here on the ground. Overall, according to President's office, there are more than a dozen world leaders physically present here in Kyiv, and more than 20 have joined online. In this very crucial moment for Ukraine, when on the one hand, Ukraine is commemorating the third anniversary of Russia's full-scale invasion, but also during the times when there is this huge rift in the relations between Ukraine and its key ally, United States, when United States is turning almost 180 degrees from its prior positions and its prior supports to Ukraine. And moreover, this week, President Macron and UK Prime Minister will both be in Washington, D.C. to meet with President Donald Trump to reiterate once again the importance of continued support to Ukraine at this crucial time.
So today, of course, is the third anniversary of the full-scale invasion. Vladimir, I'm curious about what you're seeing as of how the mood has changed in Ukraine since the first days of the war.
Carolyn, the mood, of course, has changed significantly. In the early days of the war, there was a total panic and chaos among Ukrainians because most of the people in Ukraine did not believe all those warning signs that were coming from Ukraine's Western partners and other analysts saying that the Russian attack or the Russian invasion is imminent. So obviously, when it happened on the dawn of February 24th, 2022, people were panicking. People were totally confused. They did not know what to do. They were trying to flee their homes. They were trying to flee the country. Now, 3 years into the war, people are much more resilient. On the one hand, because they have lived through so much in these 3 years. They have seen so much suffering. They have seen so much destruction. And they have seen so much loss during these 3 years.
There was this big sense of patriotism, of the country coming together, and optimism after Ukrainian troops were able to prevent Russian troops from taking Kyiv and really push them back significantly in those first few days of the war. Has some of that optimism and patriotism and feeling that Ukraine would win, has some of that faded as well?
Look, I think that Ukrainians right now, they do have the faith in their army. They do have the faith in their country and the leadership of their country. And they are still very much united. They are still very much resilient in the face of this aggressor, which has an overwhelming force, an overwhelming army, and the overwhelming amount of weapons. But again, Carolyn, at the same time, even though Ukrainians are resilient and they're standing united, they're also tired. It's been 3 years, 3 years of constant, as we discussed earlier, drone attacks of, you know, nearly every night, if not every night, definitely every week, missile attacks, blackouts that are happening both in the summer when it's very hot outside and the ACs are off, also in winter when it's very cold and there is no heating. Russia is targeting Ukrainian energy infrastructure. Russia is targeting and destroying Ukrainian hospitals, schools. So, of course, all of this horror that Ukrainians have endured over these 3 years, it takes its toll on the people. And the people, they truly want the war to be over. They want the peace to come. But most importantly, Carolyn, is that they want the peace to be just. They want a just peace and a just ending to this war.
Volodymyr Soloviov is a Ukrainian journalist. He joined us from Kyiv.
Israeli military tanks have rolled into parts of the West Bank. It is a clear escalation of military force. It's been some 20 years since Israeli tanks last entered this part of the Palestinian territory. For weeks, the IDF has been targeting towns and refugee camps in the West Bank. The country's defense minister, Israel Katz, has now said the tanks are part of a, quote, extended stay. We asked Ubay Aboudi for his reaction to these developments. He's a Palestinian human rights activist with the Bassan Center for Research and Development in Ramallah.
I was amazed. There's no reason for those tanks to enter. And according to the UN, this is not an active conflict area. This is a population that's mostly unarmed. And even whatever militants we have here, they are lightly armed. Tanks are not what you call it an accurate weapon or a weapon that can be used surgically. It's a weapon that is used to cause massive destruction. And when used in urban areas, it actually does, even if it doesn't fire its big gun, just the tracks walking on the streets, they will cause massive destruction. And this is what's been happening.
What are you hearing, Ubay, from Palestinians who are fleeing their homes in these areas where tanks have shown up?
The Palestinians have fled their homes even before the tanks arrived.
Yeah.
We have around 50,000 Palestinians displaced in the West Bank from areas of Jenin, mostly Jenin refugee camp, but also from the surrounding neighborhoods around it. Since 2 days ago, they started a siege on Qabatia, which is a major town in Jenin governorate, and they started also destroying the infrastructure there. We have in Tul Kerem, the two refugee camps, Tul Kerem and Nur Shams refugee camp also have been completely displaced. And a smaller refugee camp in Tubas has been displaced. Even a small town like Tammun, which is mostly an agricultural town, some areas of it have been displaced. The Israelis are very frank about it. They want to ethnically cleanse the Palestinians of their lands. And people should understand when talking about the West Bank, you are talking about a civilian population that is not armed.
Has Israel explicitly stated that ethnic cleansing is the goal?
Well, they haven't used the word, but they said that they want to annex Palestinian lands and that Palestinians should move away to other areas. So what does this mean? This means ethnic cleansing. They describe the action without saying the words.
As for the comments made by Israel's defense minister, Israel Katz, about Palestinian residents who have fled and will not be allowed back, it's not totally clear whether he's saying they'll never be allowed back or if he's just talking about for now. What is your understanding of what he said?
Well, he said that they will not allow them to return until the end of this year. And people should understand that most of the times when Israel says any measure is temporary, it's actually a long-term measure.
Do we know how much of this IDF campaign in the West Bank is endorsed by the U.S. government?
I didn't hear anything from the U.S. government saying otherwise. The new U.S. ambassador to Israel, Huckabee, even doesn't want to call it the West Bank, and he calls it Judea and Samaria. The Trump administration hasn't voiced any concerns.
What reaction have you seen from the international community?
Well, largely condemnation from almost all states, except of the U.S., of course. We've seen Europe talking about the need to de-escalate the situation in the West Bank, but we know that Israel does not listen unless it faces consequences. What happened is that until now that Israel has faced zero consequences for its actions. So it did not change course.
Ubay, you've been a human rights observer in the West Bank for many years. Does this moment feel different to you?
Well, this moment feels like it's the beginning of a new era. It feels like that Israel has lost all forms of sanity and governance, and they are just fully endorsing the ethnic cleansing policies of the extreme far right in Israel. And I think that at this moment also the world is realizing that the situation cannot continue as is.
Ubay Aboudi is a Palestinian human rights activist with the Bassan Center for Research and Development in Ramallah. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Egg prices have been soaring in the U.S. as bird flu wipes out entire flocks of laying hens. So the U.S. is turning to a friend on the other side of the Atlantic for help, Turkey. Turkey is planning to export 15,000 tons of eggs to the U.S. to help stabilize the market. The World's Duri Buscarin reports from Istanbul.
I did not realize how high egg prices were in the U.S., so I called a local expert, my mom.
Anyway, the best price on eggs this week is $4.99 a dozen. Now that's on sale.
She recorded this in our hometown grocery store in Colorado, where the $4.99 a dozen deal was sold out. Organic eggs were at least $8 a dozen. So I went to buy eggs in Istanbul to compare. A late snow is falling as Yunus Yildiz holds court at a weekly produce market. Women in big coats jostle for dark green bunches of chard, baby lettuce, and an early spring green called kaldırık. Nestled in a bucket full of straw is the real prize, fresh eggs straight from the chickens in the village where Yildiz lives. Right now, they cost 10 liras each. That comes out to about $3.25 a dozen. A little pricier than what you might find in a Turkish grocery store, but not much. Yildiz says there are about 300 chickens in the village. In nice weather, he says, the hens kind of take care of themselves, pecking around the dirt for grass and bugs. While village eggs are strictly for local consumption, Turkey is actually one of the world's top egg exporters, and they've exported eggs to the U.S. before. According to the Turkish Egg Producers Central Union, Turkey exported 200,000 tons of eggs to 55 different countries last year. The organization's president, Ibrahim Afyon, appeared on Bloomberg HT, a Turkish channel, to talk about their response to bird flu. Afyon says Turkish producers occasionally see bird flu along bird migration routes, but it's managed by quarantining and culling affected flocks as soon as the virus is detected. Small outbreaks of bird flu cropped up in December, but did not spread. In the last year, Afyon says about 7% of laying chickens in Turkey were taken out of production, and that did affect egg prices, but not enough for a crisis. In the United States, 20 million egg-laying chickens died in the last quarter of 2024, a record. The virus has jumped to cows and even farm workers. And as the new Trump administration cuts staff trying to stop the outbreak, experts are concerned there's no end in sight.
I'm afraid that it's going to get worse before it's going to get better.
Bruce Babcock is an agriculture economics expert at the University of California, Riverside. He says there are a lot of reasons the U.S. has been hit hard by bird flu. The outbreak is driven by particularly contagious strains. The public health response has been slow. And Babcock says the U.S. supply chain depends on large-scale production.
The United States egg producers overwhelmingly favor very large facilities, millions of birds.
When bird flu hits a big facility, that's millions of birds that are then killed to prevent the infection from spreading.
That represents a fairly large proportion of the U.S. egg supply that is destroyed.
A more decentralized egg industry made up of lots of smaller producers, like in Turkey, can help keep the egg supply nimble and productive. Over the next 6 months, Turkey is projected to export 33 million pounds of eggs to the U.S., earning about $26 million in the deal, according to the Egg Producers Union. For The World, I'm Duri Buscarin, Istanbul.
Authorities in Juba, the capital of South Sudan, say at least a dozen students have been fainting in classrooms each day. The cause? An unrelenting heat wave.
I'm currently in Juba, where temperature is as high as 107.
That's Roba Banti, Director of Humanitarian Operations for Save the Children's Juba office. I asked him what the heat has meant for more than 4 million school-aged children in South Sudan.
We have been facing this temperature for the past couple of weeks, and it has now forced the government to close the schools across South Sudan as a result for the second year in a row.
Describe for us what it's like to be in a classroom these days in South Sudan. What does it look like? What does it feel like to be there in such heat?
So you can imagine a classroom with over 60 children, no air conditioning. barely any ventilation, and outside temperatures soaring. You can imagine children trying to concentrate while sweating pouring down on their faces, feeling dizzy, exhausted, and might have come to school without eating, and therefore collapsing in school due to heat stroke. This is the reality for children in South Sudan at the moment.
And yet, before the schools were closed, kids were still showing up for school?
Yes, this has also immediate health risks in terms of children's bodies are still, you know, developing, which makes them more vulnerable to extreme heat. Prolonged exposure can lead to dehydration, dizziness, and exhaustion, and eventually heat stroke. In class with up to 30 and 40 kids in the same class under such temperature, so they will be exposed to dizziness, exhaustion, and in worst cases, collapsing due to the heat stroke. So that means it is very difficult to be a child and to be going to school in South Sudan at this time of the year.
What kind of options do school officials have when there's this kind of heat? Is there anything they can do to try to make things more comfortable for students besides closing schools?
So we need to provide a proper hydration and cooling services at the school as much as possible. We believe as Save the Children, it is a time for other actors to step in terms of providing a child-friendly services during this tough time in South Sudan.
I understand that changes to the school year have been suggested to try to address this. Can you tell me anything about that?
In South Sudan, you know, we have a rainy season starting in May that goes up to December. That comes with its own challenges. During the rainy season, ranging from July through December, we will have a huge access challenges across South Sudan, where schools are affected by floodings, flash floods, and as a result, the schools will be forced to be closed even during the rainy season.
Yeah, the suggestions that I read about were that the calendar should be shifted so that kids are not in school during these super hot months. But it sounds like you're saying then the rainy season poses challenges.
Yes, it comes with its own challenge as well. Yeah.
So when young people miss a lot of school anywhere, there are, of course, consequences. What are the specific concerns for students there in South Sudan?
Whenever children are out of school, they face high risk of never returning. And we have witnessed this during the COVID pandemic. Mm. And in countries like South Sudan, where you have almost 2.8 million children out of school, even before this crisis, due to poverty, conflict, and displacement, the heat wave is making an already dire situation worse. So this trend, at least for the last 2 years, shows the worsening heat wave situation across South Sudan as a result of the global climate change.
Roba Banta directs humanitarian operations for Save the Children in Juba, South Sudan, which is in the midst of a prolonged heat wave.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Germany is about to get a new chancellor. Friedrich Merz, who leads the conservative Christian Democratic Party, won the most votes in yesterday's election. In his victory speech, Merz spoke about steering Europe in a new direction to achieve independence from the U.S. The far right also made big wins. The AfD, or Alternative for Germany Party, got the second most votes, so it will be the second most powerful party in Germany's new parliament. The World's Europe correspondent Orla Barry has been following the results. Tell us more about Friedrich Merz, Orla, the next chancellor, and what the Conservative Party will look like under his leadership.
Well, first thing to say is he's known as an Atlanticist. Up till now, he's been seen as the most pro-American of German chancellors. He reckons he's been in the US more than 100 times, apparently. He's a lawyer by profession, but started out full time in politics back in the late 80s with the Christian Democratic Party. That's the party of Angela Merkel. And his ascent in the party was effectively derailed by Merkel in the 2000s. She actually wrote in her memoir recently, there was one problem right from the start. We both wanted to be the boss. So he turned his back on politics and went off and worked as a corporate lawyer with a number of US firms. and his relationship with Merkel has never been the best, we understand. He was asked about it again this afternoon at a press conference if she had congratulated him, and he said, well, I have hundreds of text messages on my phone. I haven't read them all yet. But he's, you know, he's a very different character from her. He's much more forceful, an impulsive type of personality, more right wing. He came back into politics after she resigned, but he hasn't served in government, which a lot of critics are talking about today. He has, throughout this campaign, talked about his businessman credentials, which he says will be useful for Germany's economy, and also dealing with President Trump.
Right. So tell us what kind of reaction Merz got after stating last night Europe's going to steer its own direction and achieve, as he put it, independence from the U.S.
They were certainly surprised at how forceful he was. He made those comments just as the votes were being finally confirmed, but he repeated them again on German TV last night.
Ich hätte nicht geglaubt, dass ich so etwas mal in einer Fernsehsendung sagen muss, aber spätestens.
He said, I never thought I would say this on television, but after Donald Trump's statements last week, it's clear that the Americans, at least the Americans in this administration, are largely indifferent to the fate of Europe. He said he'd already had conversations with other European leaders to strengthen Europe as much as possible so we can achieve independence from the US. He talked about NATO. He said there's a NATO summit coming up in June. And I'm curious, he said, whether we'll still be talking about NATO in its current form or whether we'll have to establish a new independent European defence capability. But I talked to Gesine Weber, who's an expert on European defence with the German Marshall Fund earlier. And she was saying to me, first of all, the comments weren't what she expected to hear. But she pointed out it's reassuring for Ukraine.
Simply because the overwhelming majority of forces in the German parliament still clearly support the idea that Europeans must help Ukraine to win this war and to prevail. But to some extent, time might be the biggest problem here. Germany is now in the process of forming a government or will enter this process. And we can expect it, I think, to take until Easter, so roughly 2 months.
And in that 2 month time frame, it's a caretaker government that will be in place, still under Olaf Scholz. So a lot, I guess, can't happen in that 2 month period as well, which might be frustrating for Ukraine.
So Friedrich Merz and his Conservative Party won the most votes. But a big takeaway from the election was a result for the far right, which had a lot of anticipation as well as concern. They came in second. How are Germans responding to that today?
I mean, in some ways, it was expected because the polls had predicted it. But I've heard many on German TV today talking about it as a watershed moment for Germany. They won 20%, which is double the vote that the AfD had just 3 years ago. Alice Weidel, the party leader, she was visibly elated at the result both yesterday and at a press conference this morning. She was asked today if she'd heard from Elon Musk, and she said yes, he had personally congratulated her. You know, people are frustrated in Germany with issues such as migration. There were a series of attacks before this election carried out allegedly by asylum seekers, which the AfD used in its campaign to talk about cracking down on migration. And it appealed to a lot of voters. Also today, just looking at the results a short time ago, younger voters have turned both to the far right and to the left-wing party, Die Linke, and away from the centrist party. But undoubtedly, there is a gender divide in the vote for the AfD among the younger generation. It's young men overwhelmingly who voted for the AfD this time around.
So a new chancellor presumably means new priorities for Germany. What is at the top of the list for Friedrich Merz, do you think, going forward?
Yeah, he was asked this afternoon a short time ago to sort of list his priorities. Number one, he said, was foreign and security policy. Number two, migration. He's been very vocal about wanting a much stronger migration policy, stricter border controls, etc. I mean, certainly given the strength of support for the AfD, the far right party, you can see why he wants to be seen to be very proactive in introducing a new stricter policy. How easy that'll be remains to be seen. And then the third issue is the economy. The economy has been anemic for the past few years. The automotive industry that Germany is most famous for, Volkswagen, etc., it's been struggling. And he said this afternoon, the first thing we have to do is preserve industrial jobs in Germany. But there will be pressure on the government. There'll be pressure on the government to form quickly and then to govern effectively, or else, and he has admitted this himself, or else the far right, the AfD party could well achieve its goal of becoming the front runner in the next elections in 4 years' time.
The World's Europe correspondent Orla Barry on Germany's national elections, which were held yesterday. Orla, thank you very much.
Thanks, Marco.
And now let's catch you up on a few things you might have missed.
In Haiti, law enforcement officers are demanding better protection after gunmen killed a Kenyan policeman who was part of the UN-backed mission there. The leader of one police union called for more equipment and backup as they try to fight back gangs that control 85% of Haiti's capital.
Japan and the Philippines are doubling down on their defense collaboration because of alarm over China's increasing aggression in the region. The two countries signed agreements in Manila today, where concern over the disputed South China Sea and East China Sea was high on their agendas.
And good news from the Greek island of Santorini, which has seen some 20,000 tremors and earthquakes over the past month. Scientists from the University of Athens say the earthquake swarm is in gradual decline now. Schools remained closed on Santorini and many other restrictions are still in place. But scientists said today they are encouraged by the recent slowdown of the earthquake swarm.
And those are a few things you might have missed. In Venezuela, there's stress over economic instability, compounded by fear of an authoritarian government committing arbitrary arrests, torture, and disappearances. And yet people have not forgotten how to laugh. The World's TV's Isaiah reports that along with everything else Venezuela is going through, the country is in the midst of a comedy boom.
Every Thursday night for several years, a prominent comedy club in Miami is entirely sold out, thanks to this man.
Buenas noches!
George Harris is probably the most successful Venezuelan comic nowadays. His audience is not only in Miami, where many Venezuelan immigrants live, but also from Madrid, Amsterdam, Ohio, New Jersey. People travel from all over the world to see his stand-up routine, which is inspired by the struggles of Venezuelans and how they compare to first world's problems.
Venezuelans, sometimes we have no water, no power. We have problem with violence. And here the problems are that people, you know, want to change gender or want to send your kid to Boston to study in the best university of the world. And that's the distance between two different worlds, you know.
Harris is part of a generation of comedians who experienced Venezuela's economic collapse and increasing repression. And they find inspiration in adversity.
¿Cuántas veces no estaba uno en una fiesta y de repente la gente baila? Ya va, espérate, déjame ver. Y se asomaba al balcón, está el carro.
Like a couple at a party having to constantly dance their way to the window to check if their car is still there.
Que en una de esas...
These comedians joke about hyperinflation, food shortages, hospitals falling apart, and how people adapt to these problems in creative ways.
It's not that we have to be a victim or we have to just cry in this stage and say, oh, you know, we are just a poor little things. No, it's talking about real things, making jokes.
Close to a third of the Venezuelan population left the country over the past decade, and among them, many comedians. They now fill venues of all sizes across Latin America and Spain, where most Venezuelans have migrated. Estefania León, a young Venezuelan comedian in Mexico City, never thought she would be able to joke about so much tragedy.
Nos fuimos...
She says she left Venezuela feeling lost and angry. At one point, she was rejecting her Venezuelan identity, but gradually she was able to transform those feelings into humor.
El cambio viene, y viene ya. ¡Gloria al Bravo!
León is one of three producers of El Cuartico, or The Little Room, a weekly video sketch streaming on social media. One of their most famous episodes is named Living Cheaply in the U.S. is Possible.
Vivir barato en el corazón de la ciudad de Miami es posible.
Here, León plays a Cuban realtor in Miami who's trying to convince immigrants to rent a car trunk as a home for $2,500 a month. Another episode features a drunk authoritarian man who won't leave a party that finished hours ago.
Ay, ¿qué pasó? Comandante, golpe. No, comandante, la fiesta se acabó.
La música.
They are mocking President Maduro's refusal to give up power. Many comedians abroad, like George Harris, can't return to their homeland.
They're looking for me. If I go back, they take me to jail. They will do something to me.
Harris is facing an arrest warrant for allegedly promoting hate, and he hasn't been to Venezuela for over 10 years.
When you make someone laugh, you open the heart. And that's the power that we have with the people. That's why dictators, they don't like comedians, because they have more power than them.
Most Venezuelan comedians work and live outside their country and are free to say whatever they want. But the ones in Venezuela have to be much more careful. Carluis Medina performs in Caracas.
El problema es que no se puede hablar claramente porque...
He says comedians there can't speak clearly about anything political because you can become a target of the government. In recent months, after Venezuela's controversial presidential election, Carluis had to cut nearly all political references from his comedy routine. He did go on tour visiting smaller cities across Venezuela.
El público lo que decía era gracias por venir. Para acá no viene nadie.
He says the public would thank him for coming where no other comedian had come in years. And this is why he wants to remain in Venezuela.
Grandes comediantes tuvieron que irse y el público quedó un poco desamparado aquí.
Because, he says, people there also deserve to laugh. For the world, I'm Tivisa Isea, Mexico City.
A city in the Brazilian Amazon has declared a state of emergency because of the giant sinkholes that have opened up in the ground. They look like very long craters. More than 1,000 people in the city of Buriticupu are at risk of losing their homes as the ground beneath them cracks open. This problem is not unique to Brazil. It is linked worldwide to deforestation and urbanization. Matthias von Marka is a professor of geography at University of Leuven in Belgium. He told me that geographers call these sinkholes by a different name.
We call them urban gullies.
And what exactly is an urban gully?
Well, in fact, a gully is a form of soil erosion that happens a lot in agricultural land. And it's mainly because water, rainwater, cannot infiltrate in the soil, runs off, and washes away the soil. Now, what we start to notice today is that a lot of these gullies also form in urban environments, and often they are much bigger than we are used to from agricultural settings.
Mm. So what are the factors that contribute to causing them in an urban setting?
Well, they're strongly linked to land use. And basically the idea is if you have rainfall, most of that rain normally infiltrates into the soil if that soil is well covered with vegetation. However, if you start to remove the vegetation and start building houses instead, all that rainwater will no longer infiltrate in the soil, but accumulate typically along roads. And you get huge amounts of water that start washing away the soil, the roads, and basically all the infrastructure surrounding it.
So how quickly can a gully like this occur? And what does it look like as it's forming and then afterward? The photos from Brazil are just striking.
Well, yeah, that's a good question. Basically, these gullies typically start forming in a few very intense rainfall events. And that means that what we call a gully head starts typically somewhere downslope, already causing some damages. But as subsequent rainfall events follow, they become bigger and bigger and bigger and start eroding away more and more parts of the city. And so usually they expand during a few heavy rainfall events, sometimes with over 100 meters during one event.
Wow.
But this whole process can last for several years. We've seen cases where gullies from 20 years still continue to expand and threaten people, houses, infrastructure, and so on.
Yeah, I know that in this Brazilian city, Buriticupu, authorities have declared a state of emergency now, although these sinkholes have been forming for something like 30 years. Are they particularly bad there based on your knowledge, or are there a lot that are this problematic?
Well, in Buriticupu, they're indeed quite severe, but there's many other cities just in the same situation, especially in sub-Saharan Africa, countries like Nigeria, the Democratic Republic of Congo, the Republic of Congo, Angola, Mozambique, all these countries have severely affected cities. One key example, for example, is Kinshasa in the Democratic Republic of Congo, where there's hundreds of these gullies threatening thousands and thousands of people.
I have to ask, you mentioned that a contributing factor is really intense rainfall. So is climate change playing a role here?
Well, we expect so. And there's still very little research about this. But from how these gullies form, we know that the more intensive the rainfall is, the bigger the risks are. And climate change is in fact predicting that rainfall intensities will increase in most areas of the world. And in fact, the increases in rainfall don't have to be that big to cause a lot more problems. That's because if you have basically a little bit more rain that cannot infiltrate in the soil, that can, in proportion, generate a lot more runoff and a lot more problems.
Matthias van Marke is a professor of geography at University of Leuven in Belgium. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. The abrupt shutdown of U.S. foreign aid is quickly causing ripple effects across the globe. In Latin America, one concern is that the loss of aid will only intensify the factors that push people to migrate. That's because a lot of the programs supported by resources from Washington were intended, in part, to improve conditions on the ground so people wouldn't feel the need to move to the U.S. Manuel Rueda has our report from Bogota.
Zenaida Garcia makes a living by making birthday cakes in her small apartment. Recently, she was involved in two projects funded by the U.S. government that gave Venezuelan migrants in Colombia funds to start their own businesses. Garcia used the money to buy a fridge, an oven, and an electric blender. Now she can make around 40 cakes each weekend for her bakery in Bogotá.
Yo lo hacía a mano con una paleta de madera. Yo te bato una torta a ti, en 5 minutos ya está lista una torta.
I was doing this by hand before, but now I can blend the ingredients for a cake in 5 minutes, she says. My business is growing and my life has changed. The program that Garcia was part of helped more than 20,000 migrants in Colombia to start their own businesses. But it has now been suspended as the Trump administration implements a 3-month-long freeze on foreign aid. Garcia was able to complete the program, which also included courses on business and personal finance. But she's sad for those who will not be able to benefit from these programs.
Porque no es nada más el dinero, sino que es que te enseña. USAID te enseña todo.
It's not just about the money, she says. They gave us hope and made us feel like important people. In 2023, the U.S. spent around $2 billion in aid programs around Latin America. Some of the funds were spent on economic projects that helped to prevent migration to the United States. Well, about a quarter of all aid money in the region went to security schemes that helped to modernize police forces and local courts so that governments in Latin America can take on drug trafficking groups and other challenges. With this kind of aid now in limbo, analysts fear the region will become more unstable.
For the criminals, there are more opportunities to operate and expand because law enforcement responses are further strained.
Bram Ibis is a security analyst for the International Crisis Group.
These law enforcement institutions need to be competitive, on the one hand with paying their people an income, but on the other hand as well, providing them with the logistical support they need.
But that's less likely to happen without U.S. support. In Colombia, 18 helicopters that were used for anti-narcotics operations were grounded by police this month because they relied on the U.S. for fuel and maintenance. And projects that sought to clear landmines from rural areas have also been suspended. Meanwhile, officials in some areas of the country are now saying they will struggle to provide basic services to migrants. Eber Quintana is the human rights ombudsman of Maicao, a town in the north of Colombia where 15% of the population is made up of Venezuelans. He says that USAID was helping to provide those living in shantytowns with drinking water. USAID projects were also helping to provide medical care. The social impact of these programs was huge, he says, and now many will shut down within a month.
The Trump administration says it's reviewing aid programs as part of its efforts to cut wasteful government spending. But some analysts say the aid programs make up less than 1% of the federal budget, and cutting them could be bad for U.S. interests.
One being curbing mass migration.
Maureen Meyer is a researcher at WOLA, a think tank in Washington.
A lot of the funding that has been provided to Latin America in recent years is precisely looking at how do you address the factors that drive people from their homes, whether that's insecurity, lack of food to lack of economic opportunities. Cutting off all of that funding goes against the U.S. interest on addressing migration and supporting countries as they receive their own citizens.
The Trump administration has told organizations that implement aid programs that they can apply for waivers to get their operations started again, especially when it comes to life-saving humanitarian aid. But hundreds of employees at USAID, the agency that administers these funds, have been suspended by the administration, and that makes it even harder to get aid programs running again. For The World, I'm Manuel Rueda, Bogota.
We've been hearing on the show about the fight for territory in the Democratic Republic of the Congo on the border with Rwanda. Rebel groups, notably the one known as M23, have been taking territory in eastern Congo with help from Rwanda. The European Union says Congo's borders are non-negotiable, and now the EU's top diplomat has announced the bloc is suspending defense cooperation with Rwanda and will also review an agreement about mining minerals there.
It's part of a larger effort to put pressure on Rwanda to stop backing M23. Meanwhile, Congo's president is under scrutiny for his handling of the crisis. On Saturday, he urged a meeting of Congolese leaders not to be distracted by, quote, internal quarrels, and says he plans to invite his critics into a new unity government. President Felix Tshisekedi says he'd reach out to everyone, including the opposition. He did not give details on what that would entail or when it would happen. His government says 7,000 people have died this year in the fighting with rebel groups.
In the capital, Kinshasa, a different problem has become a part of life: electricity outages. Growing demand is maxing out aging infrastructure, but the blackouts have been a creative spark for the music group Kingangolo Kenyatta.
The band's name means the sound that crushes. The sound they are referring to comes from people who take to the streets during power outages selling oil. It is the clanging of their metal containers, an advertisement for the oil they're selling, that the band's name refers to. All that noise inspired this five-piece band to create their own kind of sonic power.
The musicians in Kingangolo Kenyatta play electric guitars when there is electricity. For percussion, they make their own instruments from recycled plastic bottles and metal. Resourceful and experimental, capturing the sound and also the resiliency of people in the Congolese capital.
The band Kingangolo Kenyatta from Kinshasa, Congo, takes us out today. The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Robert Lang, Stephen Salyer, Curtis L. Scribner, Frederica and Howard Stevenson, the KRPL family, and Robin Torres. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.